don't have information to follow up on about that.
All right. Thank you, Peter. This is my poster for the talk. You see, if it's has naked patterns on it. It's meant to sort of bring the audience in, but at 10 o'clock on a Monday morning, it may not be the most successful. This is interesting, actually. Maybe we can, if somebody is interested in talking about this later. Megalithic art, okay? You know, it's absolutely fascinating. This is on the curbstone outside the burial mound at Newgrange in County Meath in Ireland. And if you look at the these megalithic art drawings, they absolutely, they contain lots of patterns that you'd swear you'd see in spiral defect chaos and many other natural pattern forming systems. So I actually have a theory for that. But like, I have theories for lots of things, but that's another story. Anyway, so what am I going to do today? Well, first of all, let me pose a problem for you. And then when you're thinking about the problem, you know, because I want you to try and answer it, I will give you the background, a little background as to why this problem is posed the way it is, you know, why it's a reasonable way to pose it. And then I will also give you some motivation as to why I'm asking such questions. Then I'm going to tell you the answer to the problem, okay? And providing you guys haven't got it first, which you may get close, but it'll be pretty good if you get the answer. And then I'm going to give you some simple background theory to indicate how theory might actually help you arrive at similar conclusions. So here's the problem. Actually, it's a very real problem, and Gunther Ahlers has done experiments on it, and Mike Cross and his student Paul, or his postdoc Paul, have done numerical experiments. And it's the following. I have an elliptical container, shallow. And in it, I put a high Prandtl number fluid, like some oil, okay, and heat it from below, and I heat the sidewalls, okay? And it's a high aspect ratio. It's a shallow dish, so that the ratio of either semi-major or semi-minor axis to the depth is very large, okay? And so we want to know what the pattern is that would fit in that, the convection pattern that will fit in that box. What I've drawn here is, you know, you imagine because you heat the sidewalls, you expect the fluid will rise at the sidewalls. This is unusual. If you just have insulated sidewalls, the rolls, the convection rolls, tend to like to head in at right angles. But in this instance, to make the problem as simple as possible, we're going to heat the sidewalls, so you get rising fluid at the sidewall and then descending in between and then rising here, descending, rising, and so you get roll pairs, okay? And basically the local structure, if you look locally in the box, the temperature field say X and Y will be like locally like cosine KX, okay? Where the K, of course, will change the wave number. The K, its magnitude is 2 pi over the local wavelength, and its direction tells you the direction normal to the lines of constant temperature, okay? So essentially the box consists of somehow a pattern of rolls which are almost straight, but of course they have to curve round to meet the topological constraints and the geometry of the box. All right, so now you can pose this problem as follows. You can pose it that essentially I want to minimize this energy functional, okay, which consists of two terms. One is a wave number mismatch. This is the preferred wave number, okay? picked by the pattern. Okay, this is important. It's important that this fluid be high Prandtl number, because in this case, the high Prandtl number fluid acts, although formally it isn't a gradient flow, it acts as if it's a gradient flow. So you have a wave number mismatch, and then because the rolls bend, there's a cost in bending. Okay, so the contribution to the free energy consists of wave number mismatch and bending terms. Now I'm going to show you the derivation of this equation, but I want you to also see its relation with other equations. And for instance, let's think of K here, the wave vector, what I've called the wave vector here, as the gradient of a potential, which of course it is in the convection context. It's the gradient of the phase of the temperature field or the vertical velocity field. But now I want you to think of this K, or this theta, this phase now, to be just height, okay? So this is like, if you like, del squared W, or del squared H squared, okay? And this is gradient H squared minus some fixed one, okay? So now, where would that arise? Well, supposing you had a kind of a substrate, okay, lying on top here, and you had a blister. In other words, supposing you heated this thing, this elastic medium, supposing you heated it so that it wanted to expand its area, okay? Now it blisters off the substrate, okay? And so it has a favored area. Now unfortunately, because it's tied down at the walls, it's going to have some this topological constraint. You can't have a smooth surface tied all the way around, as we'll find out. And so what the one is here, so if you think of it as you're minimizing, okay, the area. This is sort of the area of a given configuration, and this is the perfect area. So think of it as it's actually the square of, say, 1 plus dw by d, or dh by dx all squared plus dh by dy all squared, okay, which tells you the area, that's the inverse, 1 over the cosine, minus a chosen area, 1 plus k naught squared, where the 1 represents the original area, and the square root of 1 plus k naught squared represents the new area that has to be filled by the elastic sheet after it is expanded, okay? And so the difference between those two things, if the gradients are small, you work them out, you just get this expression here. And then this is just the bending, the elastic bending contribution to the elastic, total elastic energy, okay? So that you can derive this like from the basic elastic energy functional. It's also of interest because it actually connects with the class of Ginzburg-Landau free energies. If you think of K as having components F and G. Now, for this purpose, K need not be the gradient of a scalar. Okay, so its components are F and G. Well, if I call W equal F minus IG, I introduce a complex field, W, which is F minus IG, then this thing will be WW conjugate minus 1 all squared, and this will be just the gradient of W times gradient W star. So this is the Ginzburg-Landau free energy. Mm-hmm. Okay, and you're particularly interested in cases where effectively this term, this term is small compared to this term almost everywhere, but of course it can't be everywhere, because that's what allows you to regularize the vortices. Okay, so actually this problem is quite interest in many circumstances, and it's actually very non-trivial, and it's a lot of fun. So the thing is, fill in the ellipse. So I have you know, so that's what you, you know, you might think of trying to draw them all around, so on, so on. Okay, so we'll come back to that answer in a little while. Okay, now let me motivate that particular free energy. And the idea is very simple. It's simply this. You have a field. You have a field, like think of it as the temperature field, or think of W here as the vertical velocity field, which has a property that, in other words, in the absence of boundaries, you might think that you'd have a field of straight parallel rolls or stripes. And so that would be like W, the field would be some periodic function of theta, where theta is k dot x. Okay, and k can actually be any direction, okay? And there's a whole family of solutions of the original equations, if you look in the infinite plane, which are essentially just Fourier series, okay, in theta. Okay, now you can ask the question, all right, so these are exact solutions of the original equations. I'm going to also assume that they're stable. In other words, that the preferred local plan form in this particular pattern-forming system, the preferred local plan form is stripes, rolls, and not hexagons or not squares or not something else, okay? So that's an assumption I'm making, okay? So I'm in a Rayleigh number in this particular experiment. I'm in a Rayleigh number range where rolls are the dominant local plan form. Now you ask, are there modulated solutions? Are there solutions which allow the wave vector not to be just constant but slowly varying? Okay, you.
Assuming they're stable in the band of k values.
Yes, yes, yes. The band of k, a band of k values that this particular pattern will take on. Mm-hmm. So we ask, are there modulated solutions? Okay. Well, it's very easy to show that, of course, the modulated solution isn't an exact solution of the original system, okay? There has to be corrections, okay? And the small parameter here, epsilon, okay, is not the distance that you are from critical onset or anything like that. It's simply the aspect ratio. It's the ratio of the typical length of the pattern wavelength to the box size, or some macroscopic scale, maybe distance between defects or something like that. Okay? So actually, because of the translational invariance of the original solution, f of theta, you see, you can always shift the solution from taking x equals 0 to be the starting point. You could just shift it over. Okay? And therefore, if f of theta is a solution, so is f of theta plus theta naught, so for continuous theta naught. And therefore, the derivative of f with respect to theta naught, which is the derivative of f with respect to theta, will satisfy the original system linearized around this nonlinear solution. Okay? That means that when you put down the equation for this W1, these corrections, okay, you have this linearized operator acting on W1 equals a right-hand side terms which arise from the fact that the wave vector and the amplitudes are not constant but depend upon position and time slowly. Okay. Now, because the right-hand side has to lie in the range of the left-hand side, and the range of the left-hand side has this, there is a sort of a null space for the non-trivial null space, there's a solvability condition. And the solvability condition is this phase diffusion equation, which tells you how the phase changes with time. Basically, it's a non-linear diffusion equation, okay, non-linear diffusion equation, with this term added, this comes from the higher order terms, this added so as to regularize, because it turns out that this guy here, if you examine his structure, he can be something times theta yy, that's d2 theta by dy squared, and something times d2 theta by dx squared. And these somethings can change sign, okay? So in, for instance, if you think of this here, if this guy is negative or positive, whichever, you can see that this would be the reverse heat equation. Okay, and of course the reverse heat equation is a very unstable thing, so you need things to regularize it. Pardon?
How do you get to solve a building?
All right, you solve the equation for W1. Okay, so you have a linearized operator acting on W1. Okay, and on the right hand side there are terms which involve derivatives of theta or k with respect to the x and t and y. Okay, and so now you're going to ask that this right hand side, okay, is orthogonal to the solution of the null space. So it's just an orthogonality condition. Okay, and then this comes out, and it's very universal, this equation, for a whole class of flows. Now, if you didn't have high Prandtl number, if you had moderate to low Prandtl number, there would be another equation attached to this, okay, which would, in fact, you'd have a k dot u term attached to this with another equation for this field u. U is like a soft mode of the system, because inhomogeneities in the pattern structure can drive mean flows in the pattern. But for this purpose, situation, we assume that's not present. And so this actually now can be written as a free energy. And the free energy is a term which is essentially wave number mismatch, which can be well approximated just by k squared minus a fixed number squared, which I've called 1, times bending term. Okay. So this is the macroscopic description. If you like, you could also think of it as follows. If we'd had a free energy for the original system, okay, then if we simply average the free energy equation for the original system, we would get this system. We would get d theta by dt is minus df by d theta. Okay? So our goal is to try and minimize this energy function. Yes. Yes, that's true. Mm-hmm. Okay. So that's the derivation of the phase diffusion equation in the context of convection. Now, why are we sort of interested in posing this kind of problem? I mean, what's different from often people work with these kind of averaged equations, these so-called amplitude Ginzburg-Landau equations or phase diffusion equations, as sort of macroscopic average models, okay? And we get useful information from them. They identify all long-wave instabilities of various Rolle patterns, and they can even have defect solutions, and they can have very interesting local structures. Now, why am I interested in some kind of global description, which I am in this box case, because I'm giving you some boundaries. I would like to get the K field all over this box. Mm-hmm. Well, the reason actually, it's very simple. You see, and I don't need to really emphasize it this audience. Patterns are macroscopic objects, right? Patterns are macroscopic objects. They really depend less on the details of the underlying microscopic system and more on various overall symmetries that these microscopic systems enjoy. For instance, the same phase diffusion equation or the same Ginzburg-Landau equation will occur for many, many different systems of many different origins. So the question is, you know, there's this great danger in the pattern business is you want to explain something, say like fingerprints. This is a fingerprint. This is a real fingerprint in the center of your, say, thumb. Okay? And you come up with a mechanism, pick it, okay? The one I happen to like and argue for is that essentially this is mechanical, that the basal layer of the epidermis is an elastic sheet lying on the elastic foundation of the dermis, and it's under a varying tensor stress field, and that one can get patterns from that. But I could also write down reaction diffusion equations, and I can also write down a model which brings into play one of the various taxas, chemotaxas, haptotaxas. You know what haptotaxas is? It's stickiness gradient. So there's many, many models, okay? And actually, if I put the parameters in right and give this model, this microscopic model, the right overall symmetries, you better believe I can produce at least parts of patterns which look exactly like the real thing. Okay? Now there's various tests, of course, you can do. There's various tests, for instance, the pattern wavelength. You may actually know the parameters in the real system, and you may be able to say, okay, if this system forms a pattern, then the wavelength better be 2 centimeters, okay, or in some range around 2 centimeters, and then you can measure and see if that's right. But in many cases, you don't know. You know, say, the Young's modulus, maybe a skin, sort of, but the spring constant of the elastic foundation of the dermis, you don't know, or various other parameters in your reaction diffusion models, you don't know. So the great error which many people make is this looks like thing. Okay, I have a pattern, I have reproduced a pattern with my model, okay, which looks like the pattern that we see, therefore my model is correct. That's a load of nonsense, okay? All right. And so we have to ask more, okay? We have to sort of be able to, and even when we ask more, that may not prove it either, but we have to ask, well, supposing we take the full microscopic problem and try and average, take advantage of averaging over the local wavelength, okay? But then we should be able to get overall features of actually what is observed in a global way rather than just in a local way. And so so this is an attempt, for instance, let me show you my mother-in-law's fingerprints here. This is a... Actually, I should mention this one here. This is the model, the global model that my student Michael Kuchen, has constructed. Doesn't do too bad a job, I mean, for modeling the whorl and the various triradii that occur and so on. But like I say, all I'm arguing is for consistency, and that it's better than the competitors. I can't really say until very accurate measurements are made and various constants are measured properly, that definitely fingerprints result from a buckling process of the basal layer. But anyway, so that's why we started asking these questions about the global behavior patterns. Okay, so now let's get back to the problem in hand. Did you all get this much? Okay. I mean, the guess is that, okay, so what would be the rule of constructing a solution, okay? Well, you have a rising fluid at the boundary, so basically, in the big scale, the system is going to try and form straight parallel rolls whose normal is normal to the boundary, okay? So the rule would be, go in a distance of at the normal, one wavelength, okay? You know that number, you know the preferred wavelength, and then put a marker here, and then do the same at this point, and then draw this contour. So that's the next constant maximum temperature contour, okay? And keep doing it, okay? Now, is there a problem with that?
It starts what?
Caustics, yes, yes, because it's raised.
I didn't say caustics, I said the caustic gradients, but then...
No, oh, okay, I gave you too much credit. Yes, I don't normally give you too much credit, any credit, but okay. The problem is caustics, because if I continue this process, what will happen is these normals will start meeting in contours which essentially lie on contours like this. Okay? Okay, so the problem is once they start crossing, then I don't know what to do with this, algorithm. Okay.
Isn't there just the cost of the gradients even before that?
No, no. The gradients are beautifully smooth up so far here.
At the end.
Ah, yes, you're getting, yes. Well, this is not far enough in yet. Yes, this caustic, this comes these points here where you first run into trouble are the centers of curvature of those two endpoints, okay? AE squared or something like that, okay? And these curves you can write down, they're AE squared cos T and AE squared E squared over B sine T or something like that, cubed. And so on. So you have this problem that if you continue this construction, which we did, you start to get sharp corners, as Pierre has surmised, right here. Okay? But maybe that's what the system likes to do. And we continue on. And sure enough, this is to 17 rolls. And now there's a very distinct, what I'm doing is showing you the answer, but I'm not showing you the middle of the answer, you see? So what has happened is the system has allowed these sharp corners. Now there's discontinuities and derivatives from this point here out to this point here, okay? But the system is permitting that. It will regularize these sharp corners with that bending term, okay? So you might say, well, then that's the way it does it all the way in. Essentially, there's some kind of boundary along here for between these two centers of curvature, where essentially you have this and then this, and you have this discontinuity here at this end, which is smoothed out in the over the distance of the wavelength by the boundary by that fourth derivative term. Okay, and in fact, this is the solution that you would see from the elastic blister. Okay, this is what the elastic blister would do. But essentially, you would have a sharp boundary here, where there's so now you have to see this as a tent. Okay, so now there's a jump in derivatives as I go across here. So now the free energy, or the energy of this elastic blister, is essentially all supported by this line along here. You do, but I have to show you that yet. Yes, you actually get this.
The minimization you showed initially, the first one.
Yeah.
That's what you call the elastic blister.
That's the elastic blister. Let me go back to that. But actually, there's a subtlety I haven't told you yet. You see, everything here, K, the wave vector here, K, the wave vector, is the gradient of the height. Okay, the height is the gradient of the height. Okay, that is a vector everywhere in this plane. Okay, in other words, you know, it's well defined as a vector, even round here, it's well defined. Okay, so I have a vector field solution to this minimization problem. Okay, but now supposing I do the fluid problem. Okay, supposing I do the fluid problem.
Well, could you put the first equation up?
Sure.
That didn't have heights. That didn't have anything.
The first equation?
Yeah.
I did. In the first equation, in this equation for the elastic blister problem, K is the gradient of the height.
Right.
Okay.
So that's fine.
Mm-hmm.
You're saying you can define with no loss of generality. I mean, this F of K is a well-defined
energy,
and mm-hmm. you want to find the K of X and Y.
The configuration which minimizes that.
Which minimizes that. And you're saying without, because it's two dimensions, without loss of generality, you can write K equals grad H.
In for the elastic blister problem, it surfaces as grad H. Okay?
No, but
no. No, I'm saying that in the last...
Forget about anything else.
Yeah.
Is this a well-posed problem?
Well, it is for vector fields, and actually there are subtleties, because there is no proven energy minimum for non-convex problems. Okay? They have to be taken one problem at a time. They're very difficult in general. Okay?
So if I say, you mm-hmm. know, this is my problem, F
right.
of K,
right.
this is the yep. geometry,
right.
this is the boundary condition.
Yeah, that's right.
Find the K, which is a vector.
Yeah.
Define
the field, the whole field, yes. Yeah.
K of X and Y.
Which minimizes this.
Is yeah. this a well-posed problem?
It's a well-posed problem, yes. But it does not have a unique solution.
Okay, and is K equal grad H a loss of generality or not?
That's an extra constraint.
If I just
ask, for instance, in the Ginzburg-Landau case, K was just a vector field, okay?
Yeah.
If I ask K to be the gradient of something, as I did in the convection problem, okay, then that's an extra constraint. Okay.
Now,
but in the convection problem, K is at least locally the gradient of this phase. In the elastic blistering problem, K is the gradient of the height function.
I think that if I understand correctly what you're asking, if you don't have that constraint,
yeah.
then you could imagine a whole new different problem.
Absolutely different problem, yes. Now, if you don't have that constraint, you have the Ginzburg-Landau problem. And then the solutions are essentially K will be 1 almost everywhere, and the solution, you will have n vortices, and the n is determined by the total twist in the K vector given to you on the boundary. Okay? So it's absolutely different. So this constraint, if you want to think of this, the fact that the K is the gradient of a phase,
of an H which is defined globally, H, X, and Y?
H is defined globally for the elastic problem.
Yeah.
Okay. But it is not defined globally for the convection problem.
I see. So there are really three levels. One is general,
yeah.
which you call Ginzburg-Landau.
That's right.
The other is convection, where it's locally a gradient.
That's right.
And the third is the elastic blister where there's an H of
where
X and Y.
It
and
is
you
a
could ask to find the H of X and Y.
Yes.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. So we'll keep this handy because we want to go back to refer to this. So let me show you what the answer is for the convection problem. Okay? This is what you get. This is numerics. And it's also, I can show you some experiments that Gunther Ahlers did, which show these features. What has happened is the convection problem didn't like the sharp corners. Okay? See, the corners got sharper and sharper in this solution. In fact, like we look at this, the vector field solution here, the corners get sharper and sharper as you go into the center. Okay? Somehow, the convection problem wants to trade a sharp corner for something like this. It wants to take the sharp corner like that, and it wants to do something like that. It wants to grow nipples. So why does it want to do that? Okay. So it's actually very important now to go back and examine what is the nature of patterns, two-dimensional patterns, and the idea of defining global or local phases and global and local wave vectors. For instance, so it's a very good, but so let me just show you, this is Gunther Ahler's experiment. So it was a much smaller, much larger aspect ratio than we did in the numerics, but you can see the onset of the sharp corners and the nipples forming here. Okay. And so anyway, let's take a look at the objects that we see in two-dimensional patterns. Now these objects that I'm showing you here are ubiquitous. In fact, these guys here, this guy here, and this guy here, these are the building blocks. An object like this, and an object like this. These are called concave and convex declinations, and they are the fundamental point defects of two-dimensional patterns. Okay?
Roll
patterns. And also hexagonal. They're a little bit more complicated then. Now, look at what one of the properties is. Supposing I label these contours here, okay, theta equals, say, 0 here, 2 pi, and then 4 pi, 6 pi, 8 pi, okay? And I draw the gradients, okay? So let's draw the K field, okay? So I'll locally draw the K field, okay, based upon that labeling. And then I'm going to go round, I'm going to take a contour and go round this point and come back, okay? Now what happens, that vector? As you go around like this and come back, when you come back, it's facing in the other direction. Okay? So the presence of concave and convex declinations means that you never have a global wave vector field. It's really a director field. Okay? Its natural singularities, topologically, are not like the singularities we're sort of used to in field theories are z, like if we have a vector field, f minus ig goes like x minus iy, okay, or x plus iy, so f is x and g is minus y. They're saddles, or if you take 1 over z, they're vortices, okay? So these are the natural singularities just of regular vector fields. But the singularities of director fields are more like z to the half and 1 over z to the half. They're squares. In other words, if I create a tensor out of the gradient of theta, f, call d theta by dx f, d theta by dy g, and I form the tensor, the matrix, formed by taking k times its transpose, so I get f squared minus fg minus fg g squared, then that is the property that its singularities are like 1 over z and z, okay? But that's because you squared the f squared and the fg and so on. So you can think of actually these as singularities of tensor fields, or you can think of them as director fields. Okay? So director fields, and if you put various director fields together, for instance, the two concave declinations, the convex declinations. If I take the convex declinations, clearly if I put that with another one out here, two convex ones, I'll get a target pattern. If I put them in another arrangement, I get a vortex, and so on. If I put the concave declination together, if I put this together with another one and bring the two singularities close together, I'll get a saddle, and so on. Okay. So this is very interesting, because it means as follows. Supposing I just turn the picture around here. So even though when I came back to this line here, the k vector had changed direction. The convection pattern doesn't care two hoots about that. There's no energy cost. There's an energy cost in this bend here because this local wavelength gets longer, okay, and there's a bending cost here. There's a bending cost along these boundaries here where you get the sharp changes, but there is no cost at all at these other points, okay? So, but in the elastic problem, of course, there is. Because in the elastic problem, if the gradient of H was different here, I have a roof, and there is a cost to the roof. So you see, in the convection problem, there is no, if this corner is too sharp, this guy will try and make it less sharp by producing a nipple, okay? Now the sharpness is along these directions rather than along this direction, okay? And we're going to calculate what the increase, what the balance of costs is between this and this, okay? And it turns out that the critical angle here is 43 degrees, okay? So 43 degrees. So in convection patterns, you cannot have saddles, okay? Let me show you what will happen to a saddle. Okay, so this is a situation where, the bottom situation is, or this situation here is where we created a saddle in a circular box. Okay, so you see these are 45 degree angles, and then we let it go. Okay, and you can see what happens. It splits into two concave declinations, and the nature of the split is that these sharp corners, they're too sharp, and they go into these little nipples, okay? And that's exactly what we saw in the convection pattern for the solution of this, of the final convection pattern that we saw for the convection in the elliptical container.
Was this done with that function F?
No, this is done actually with the microscopic. This was Swift-Hornberg. Okay, generically, if you have saddles or things like that, they will split apart. Okay, you have to have something to keep them together if they're going to stay together. So the basic point patterns are indeed these concave and convex declinations. Okay, so now how would you sort of go about, what kind of theory might you be able to construct going back to this free energy? Okay, so now what we want to do is minimize this free energy. Okay, now one thing we could do, this g squared, remember, essentially is k squared minus 1 all squared, and gradient of theta is just k. One thing you could do is write down the Euler.
I'm a little confused about this epsilon.
Mm-hmm. That was in the. All right. What the epsilon is now? Okay, is I have moved from the scale of measuring things on the scale of the wavelength to the scale of the box. Okay. So on the scale of the box, what's going to happen is this bending term, okay, will only become large and comparable to the wave number mismatch when the rolls bend fast enough. Let's go back to the original derivation.
I understand that, but you'll have to tell us the rules of the game with respect to epsilon.
All right. Well, the epsilon, remember, is the inverse aspect ratio. In the elastic problem, it's the H, it's the thickness of the elastic sheet squared. Okay?
So you're looking only for lowest order in epsilon, lowest non-trivial order in epsilon.
That's right. Yep. Mm-hmm. Because it's the 1 over epsilon is the inverse, is the aspect ratio. And so it's very, very large. So this is an asymptotic theory. It's But that's the best you can hope for in these problems.
The gradient K doesn't have some kind of singular discontinuity, if you have this kind of sharp solutions.
Yes, and this term regularizes that. So in other words, we're going to find that K, okay, in the solutions we've been looking at, the K's varied smoothly, and then when they got round to this center line, then there was a sharp change from here to here. Okay? So there was a jump. Okay? And what this term here does is it smooths out that jump. It's like a boundary layer, and it allows you to move from this K to this K over the distance of a wavelength. I'm not sure I understand. Yes, that's true. You mean this solution when we actually had this sort of thing?
No, before, for the height problem.
Okay, where we have these things, yes. No, but in those things you get a slight regularization. Yeah, okay. Because in those cases, this guy is the bending, the effect of the bending of the...
So they're never really sharp.
They're never sharp. No, it's a boundary layer.
Who is this?
Mm-hmm.
Is this elastic, or is this...
This one is both convection and elastic now.
How do you make the difference?
There is no difference at the moment until I choose what kind of field K is. For convection, K will be a director field. For the elastic problem, it will be a vector field. So when I ask over what sets of functions do I minimize, then I... So there's an absolutely miraculous result here. Because if I write down the Euler-Lagrange equation for that free energy there, it'll be a fourth order equation. Okay? I'll have four derivatives. It'll be del 4 theta plus the divergence of essentially the vector k times dg squared by dk squared. Okay? So that's very difficult. But there are these wonderful self-dual solutions. Okay? If you ask, under what circumstances will the solutions obtained by equating the wave number mismatch energy and the bending energy, under what situations will those solutions satisfy the Euler-Lagrange equation of the full problem, the full fourth order equation? And the answer is very simple. After a little calculation, you find that the solutions of the second order reduction will satisfy the full Euler-Lagrange equation if the Gaussian curvature of the surface is zero. Okay?
So this B equation is just the derivative of F with respect to
theta.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Remind me, here K is defined as the gradient of theta.
K is defined as the gradient of theta, right?
And so the Euler-Lagrange equation is del dot K.
Yeah, plus epsilon squared del 4.
That's the Euler-Lagrange equation.
Mm-hmm.
And you're saying that find some special solution.
Right. It's not unlike field theory, electromagnetic field theory, where you can equate, you know, the self-dual equations for, you know, when you equate the two contributions to the, you know, all the instantons and everything are solutions of these things. I forget what they call the self-dual equations in that context. But the same thing happens here. As long as the solutions defined by this reduced equation have zero Gaussian curvature. Now, for instance, on the elastic sheet case, so if you kind of scrunch up an elastic sheet, almost everywhere here the Gaussian curvature is zero, okay? Even along these edges, okay? Where the edges curve, there is a bit of Gaussian curvature. The Gaussian curvature actually is conserved over the for the whole sheet, but it gets localized. It gets localized onto the points, okay? So, in fact, the Gaussian curvature in these convection patterns actually all condense onto the point centers of disclinations. Okay, we get another break because this g squared, the wave number mismatch, I mean, it's exactly k squared minus 1 all squared in the elastic energy case, but it's to a very good approximation equal to this in the pattern case, okay? Now, the reduced equation is epsilon del squared theta is just this. But that linearizes, okay? It's like a Hof-Kohl transformation. So now, the patterns can be constructed.
What is it linear in?
In psi. So if I take this, this is, think of this in one dimension as d2 theta by dx squared, and this is 1 minus d theta by dx squared. Okay, if I let theta be log psi, the two terms cancel, which are nonlinear, and you end up with a linear equation. So this self-dual reduction brings me down to the Helmholtz equation. Okay. Now, what are the solutions of the Helmholtz equation? These are very easy, some of them. Let me go just through some of them. Okay, here's a very simple one. 1 over epsilon k dot x, where k is 1. Okay, in other words, I've chosen k to be the perfect wavelength, but it can have any direction. That's just a field of parallel roles with wave vector k. Next one, let's take the sum of two of them. That's also a solution, okay? But the sum of the two of them, just simply, if you work out what the theta field is, it just gives you this regularized, this what we call a phase grain boundary, where you get this bend. Mm-hmm. So the bend isn't infinitely sharp. The bend is like a boundary layer where the solution slowly comes around from this direction to this direction, okay? Okay, now you can work out, and by the way, this guy, of course, has zero Gaussian curvature, right? Because the Gaussian curvature, okay.
So did you say it wasn't infinitely sharp? If you have K1 and K2, that's.
Yeah, no, but I have K1, this is a tanh transition. Okay? I mean, we have to work out what. Take psi, take its log. So it's, this is the psi, take. K1, it would be the x part is the same, it's constant throughout this whole region, but the y part is varies, okay? So this is like law, the solution psi is like cosh y, okay? Now take its log, okay? And now take the d by dx of that, and now you get this tanh transition.
Isn't what the wave vector of psi is, but of
exactly.
Theta.
Of what the theta is.
Yes.
So the real wave vector field makes a smooth transition between this guy and this guy. Okay? Now you can calculate, in fact, there it is. Sorry, there's the expression. You can calculate now what the free energy is. Okay? There's an energy cost from the bending and from the wave number mismatch. The wave number mismatch only occurs here where the bending occurs, and they're equal there. And what you find, it goes like the cube of this angle, the sine cubed of this angle, times the length of the contour. Okay, so that's the cost. Now, actually, you can there's lots of solutions. You can take solutions with many, many phase grain boundaries, okay, and so on, and construct a whole zoo this way. There's one interesting member of this zoo. It's like multiple dislocation solutions, okay? Multiple dislocation solutions you can also find as solutions of this. But you can go first.
From this bullhock or some other way?
No, this way. From the, yeah, from...
From the solution strip side?
Yes, I solved the Helmholtz equation. Yep. Mm-hmm.
Now, did you... Is this a vector field or is this
At the moment, they're all vector fields. The solutions I've all shown you so far is all vector fields. Yeah.
And why?
Well, actually, that's not quite true. In this case, because of the square root, they're actually director fields. You have to distinguish on the y equals zero axis. Okay. Yeah. Right. Well, for don't forget what locally near the dislocation, what things look like. Of course, is there is bending. Okay, so this thing comes down here. So it, you know, if you sort of calculate what it is, it's actually it has this self-similar form of, or if this is y and this is the x direction, so there is a cost. So. Okay, now we can ask, yeah, so now let's ask, we can do more. Let's turn it upside down. So I want to solve this using that Helmholtz equation. See? So how do you solve the Helmholtz equation? It's epsilon squared del squared psi minus psi equals zero. So I'll solve it using a Green's function. Psi will be psi on the boundary. And I'm going to take the temperature constant on the boundary, so I'll forget about him. And then times the Green's function, okay? But the Green's function is really for the infinite case, which we can take here because its large aspect ratio is k naught. But k naught in the small epsilon limit is really e to the minus. So here, this is a point x, okay? Okay, it says it's e to the minus x minus xs, where xs is some point in the boundary, so it's that distance, times dxs, okay? All right. So the solution of the Helmholtz equation tells me that that's what the field psi would be inside. Okay? But because epsilon is small, I can do steepest descents. I can approximate. You know, where does the biggest contribution, I mean, this xs runs all the way around the boundary, where's the biggest contribution? Well, the biggest contribution comes from the point xs, which is closest to this point. Okay. So the solution then will be a single exponential. Psi will be a single exponential whose wave vector is that distance and whose wave number is 1. Okay. So that's just these roles that come out like that. Now, they have zero Gaussian curvature because even though there's a curvature in the constant temperature contour running around like this, in this direction, theta varies linearly. Okay? So the Gaussian curvature, remember, is the product of curvatures. Okay? So the curvature in the direction along the normal is zero. Okay? So now you kind of, when would that fail? Well, it does fail because if I go marching on in here, when I reach a point here on the middle, okay, now there'll be 2 points on the boundary at which the main contributions come from. So now the solution at this, in the points in this neighborhood, will be the sum of two exponentials, k1, which will be that k, and k2, which will be that k. Okay. Now, what was the when I took the sum of exponentials? What did that give rise to? Just the phase grain boundary. So this gives you the phase grain boundary solutions. So actually, by just arguing just the general solutions of the Helmholtz equation in such a region, one can arrive at the vector field solution. Okay. Now, what this does not take account of, essentially, this solution here using this. You see, there was a little bit of a fast hand maneuver when I made this transformation. I don't know whether you noticed there was a plus or minus in the self-dual reduction. And the thing is, you see, the difficulty is, even though you can linearize, okay, in for director field solution, for some parts of the plane, you take the plus sign, and the other parts of the plane, you take the minus sign. Okay? So really, you can't do everything, you can't do it globally for the director field solutions. But you can get the vector field parts, of course, and that's what we've done in this case. Now, for the director field parts, okay, we ask now, is this solution, which we get from the vector field part, is that stable to director field perturbations? Okay? So now, if you, I'll finish on this, okay? Well, let's actually do the calculation, okay? Actually, let me do it on the blackboard. I'll put this up here. That's enough. Yes, if we could have the lights. Thank you. So, okay. All right. So, supposing I have a phase grain boundary like this. Okay? Now remember, this is smoothed around the corner, but I'm just drawing the global picture. So now I have the normal to this guy is like this. So this is phi. Okay? Now I claim I can minimize the free energy from this point on by trading in that phase grain boundary where you get all these sharp curves by doing the following. I put in another phase grain boundary which bisects this angle in the two directions like that. And so now the constant phase contours, instead of going round and continuing on down there and coming back out like this, will do this. Okay? All right? So I'm trading in this solution for this solution. Now, what's the advantage? The advantage is you can see the bend here is much less than the bend would have been had it gone on. On the other hand, however, the distance, that length, is a huge amount more than that length. Okay? So sort of, so I'm asking, how much did this little thing cost versus how much did the bends along here and along this other side cost? Okay? So let's do a little geometry. So this is phi, this angle's phi. This is a right angle, because this is the normal to the phase contours. This angle here is pi over 2 minus phi. Okay? This bisects this angle here, so each of these is pi over 4 plus phi over 2. Okay? So this is pi over 4 plus pi by 2. This is a right angle, so this actually is pi over 4 minus phi by 2. So the direction that the new k, that the k, okay, in other words, the k, the perpendicular to these phase contours, makes with the phase grain boundary is now this angle and not phi. Okay? So I have to compare sine cubed phi times this length, okay, with what? Sine cubed pi over 2, pi over 4 minus phi by 2. But now I have two of them, but also I have to divide by cos pi by 4 plus phi by 2, because this length is longer than this length by that amount. Okay? So this guy is what? This, of course, is sine of pi by 4 minus phi by 2. So this is all just twice sine squared pi by 4 minus phi by 2, which is 1 minus cos pi, the double angle, minus phi, which is 1 minus sine phi. So now I compare, and this guy is greater than this guy when phi is greater than 43 degrees. So you can see this. You know, we've done sort of experiments, and I have them somewhere yet. Let's see this here.
this now is for directors?
Now we have got director fields, because let me show you. Because now, you see, there's a little cost to the circle that goes on the end. That's logarithmic. So now there's a cost to this. Yes.
To this thing.
That's right. Because you have an edge. Exactly. That's right. Exactly. And the convection field, the convection doesn't care whether I label this theta equals 0, 2 pi, and then change theta, call this 2 pi as well. So this is no cost to convection, even though the wave vectors are pointing in different direction. So what is this? This is a V. That's a concave declination. And this is an X. So you see, you get the spontaneous creation of a VX pair from a field which has got too many sharp curves. Okay? That's not unknown in physics, that you get spontaneous particle-antiparticle creation. Hmm? Okay, so now let's just take a look at this. So this is just a numerical verification of these nipples occurring. But now let me just end up by showing you, the way in which this problem sits in the family of Ginzburg-Landau problems, because it's rather fascinating. Okay? The original harmonic map problem is says, I want to minimize this kind of del k. This isn't divergence k, this is df by dx, if k is the components f and g, this is df by dx squared plus df by dy squared plus dg by dx squared plus dg by dy squared, okay? So you want to minimize this with where the length of the vector is constant, okay? And the answer is you can't do that in a closed region unless the index of the wave vector given on the boundary is zero. In other words, you could have the wave vector on the boundary change, but it can't completely spin around. Okay? It could change and then go back and that sort of thing. Okay? So that's the criterion that you can solve the first problem. How that problem was handled was that people put in these potentials, okay? Essentially Lagrange multipliers. They said, well, we want k to be 1, but not everywhere, okay? So you add in this 1 minus k squared squared as a Lagrange multiplier, okay? Now that's just our problem, okay? Now, if you're looking for vector field solutions of this, it turns out this problem was solved by Bethuel, Brzee, and Helene, absolutely lovely paper, in which they actually not only tell you what the solutions are, they're essentially harmonic maps outside of these vortices, they tell you where the positions of the vortices are in our ellipse. Mm-hmm. But, of course, in our problem, as you pointed out, there's a huge difference. There's a constraint on this vector field. In one case, it's the gradient of a scalar, okay? And, of course, we're also in two cases, one the gradient of a thing which is global, like in the elastic case, and the other case in the convection case where it's really a director field. So the free energy, of course, of this guy was minimized not at points, but along lines, okay, for the vector field. But for the director field, if you remember, it started getting localized again along a whole lot of VX pairs, okay? So it was like a dense set of points replaced the straight line, okay? So actually the full minimization of all this has not been looked at, and there would be a very...
What does that mean?
Well, we don't really know what the minimizers are for the director field case. We have numerics, but there's no good theory. We don't have a theory like Bethuel, Brzee, and Helene for the director field situation.
You do for the vector field?
Yes.
So what's the difference?
The director field K,
I know what's the difference between a vector field and a director field.
Yeah.
But what's the difference?
All right. In the vector field case, the singularities were lines. No, I didn't put it over on you. I showed you the singularities were phase grain boundaries. They were lines, not points.
In the vector field.
Yeah. In the vector field case. Okay?
Right.
So adding the constraint that you want K to be the gradient globally of a potential means that the point vortices, the point singularities of Ginzburg-Landau now become lines, these phase grain boundaries. When you go to a director field, these phase grain boundaries, large portions of them break up into sequences of Vx pairs.
Yes.
Okay? Okay, so it's really, now you're back to point singularities, but they get rather dense.
And in what sense do you say that you proved it for one and not for the other?
Well, we have because for the director field case, we really only have numerical evidence. I can give you rough arguments as to why this nipple solution is preferred, because I can show you how to lower the free energy, but I do not know that that's in any way a minimizer.
Whereas for the
Vector field,
you have showed.
Well, again,
it's
subtly. No, it's precise. What we can show is that the energy that we say is the configuration I showed you of the phase grain boundary, his energy is the minimum energy. In other words, I can upper bound and lower bound the minimum energy. I can actually not tell you that the configuration I showed you is the unique minimizer, because there are known theorems for that.
I see.
Okay? But...
And for the director, you can't even do that.
And I can't even do that. But, I mean, for the vector field, it's pretty obvious that that is the minimizer. It's certainly... So you can prove, you see, in the proofs of these problems, it's very easy to get upper bounds. We can upper bound with self-dual solutions. It's very difficult to get lower bounds, so as to kind of pin the solutions that way. But now, actually, you can go further, okay? You can relieve the gradient constraint by putting in another Lagrange multiplier. Okay, so now this is completely open. So, by the way, when you make this zero, then the gradient k that appears here and the div k turn out to be the same thing. Okay, they differ by just a surface integral. Okay. So now this is a completely open problem. This problem actually turns up in some magnetostatic context that I've seen this. So you have a constraint here which you allow loosen a little bit, okay? You don't demand that K is one everywhere, but mostly everywhere. You don't demand that this is zero everywhere, but maybe mostly everywhere. So the question is then, can you say what the minimum configurations look like in the epsilon and mu going to zero limits?
That means you allow sources of...
Yes, clearly the limits won't commute. If you let epsilon go to zero and keep this finite but small, you'll get the Ginzburg-Landau, you'll get vortices. If on the other hand you do it the other way around, you get these lines for vector field solutions, or for the director field solutions, you get these dense sets of points. So you can see actually even the simplest problem, posing the problem to find what a global pattern is actually not very trivial. So, well, that's, thanks for bearing with me so long. I went on another 15 minutes. Thanks.